Radio Prague News.
President Miloš Zeman has vetoed a conflict of interest bill approved by Parliament. The President has invited Pope Francis to visit the Czech Republic, and a fifth of Czech Post employees are planning to join a two-hour strike on Monday in support of a demand for higher wages. President Miloš Zeman has vetoed a conflict of interest bill designed to rein in potential conflicts of interest among public officials. The bill would ban ministers from media ownership and would bar companies where ministers have more than a 25% stake from receiving state subsidies, taking part in public tenders and accessing investment aid. The legislation was said to have a major impact on Finance Minister and ANO leader Andrej Babiš, whose many business and media interests have long come under fire from opponents and anti-corruption activists. The president's spokesperson said Mr. Zeman had numerous reservations to the law, which he considered to be in violation of the constitutional order. It is expected that the president's veto will be overturned by the lower house. President Miloš Zeman has invited Pope Francis to visit the Czech Republic. In a congratulatory telegram on the occasion of the Pope's 80th birthday, Mr. Zeman spoke highly of the head of the Catholic Church, saying that while the Czech Republic was regarded as an atheist country, the Pope was held in high regard by Czechs and viewed as a moral authority. Mr. Zeman said it would give him great pleasure to welcome Pope Francis in Prague. The Czech president was received in the Vatican last year. President Zeman has signed into force a tougher new law on terrorism. Under the new legislation, expressing public support for a terrorist act will be a crime punishable by 3 to 12 years in prison. Aiding or financing terrorist activities will also merit tougher punishment than in the past. Newly, the threat of a terrorist act will also be judged as a crime. The amendment reflects the present international situation and is in line with legislative changes made in other EU member states. The collecting and filing of DNA samples by police should in future be governed by law, according to an amendment to the law approved by the government on Monday. At present, the decision whether or not to collect a sample and file it is in the hands of the police, a state of affairs that has been criticised by human rights activists and NGOs as potentially dangerous. A database of DNA samples was established in 2002 and it now contains over 200,000 samples. The draft law will now go to the lower house for debate. Prague Supreme Court has overruled the verdict in the David Rath corruption case on the grounds that the wiretapping used as key evidence in the case was illegal. The judge ruled that the court order licensing the wiretapping was not adequately justified. The case will now go back to the city's regional court to be heard again. The verdict was made public earlier, but not the reason for the court's decision. David Rath, a former minister and regional governor, was last year found guilty of bribe-taking and sentenced to 8.5 years in prison. And finally, a quick look at the weather forecast. Tuesday should be partly cloudy to overcast with snow or sleet showers and day temperatures between -1 and 3 degrees Celsius. I'm Daniela Lazarová and that's the end of the news.
You're listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio, with me, Chris Johnston. Coming up in today's programme, sex workers march against violence in Prague. At long last, the D8 motorway is launched, and a US academic discusses the relevance of Václav Havel. All that coming up, so please stay with us. A march to commemorate the International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers took place on Saturday in Prague. Around 24 women took part, holding symbolic red umbrellas and calling for greater action to be taken to ensure the safety of sex workers. Hanna Malinova runs the NGO Roskos Bez Rizika, or Bliss Without Risk, for which the last 2 decades it's provided medical and consultancy services to women involved in prostitution. Dominic Kuhn began by asking her of the dangers faced by those involved in the Czech sex business.
Since 2000, we have more than 30 victims, female and male, of violence killed. But this is the top of ice because most of them that is not known they are sex workers. We did big research, and I can say that only 10% of sex workers didn't face violence from the customer or from the so-called third part and so on. The day to end violence against sex workers, it starts since 2003 for commemoration, a serial killer, USA was convicted. His victims were young women, mostly sex workers.
Could you explain the sort of legal framework under which prostitution or sex work exists in the Czech Republic? Presumably street crawling is banned, so lots of sex workers end up in so-called nightclubs and indoors. How exactly does it work and what are the dangers?
Top is women in the street, but our regulation in many cities and many places is forbidden to offer sexual services on the public place. What is a new group endangered by violence, mostly from customers, they are the girls and women in private flats, yes. They were mostly alone and there is no protection and they have no one to call. They have not developed like prevention of violence, prevention tricks, some tricks how to protect themselves against violence and so on. This is what our organization is now preparing, some manual concerning how to avoid violence.
What specific measures are you calling for, do you believe, would decrease the risk of violence against sex workers? One of them, I understand, is these so-called toleration zones, where specific areas in cities in which this would be tolerated.
This is only one possibility, but the attitude of our authorities is not very friendly to these ideas. First, it is not just cheap institute. As I could see in Holland and in Germany, so-called tipper zones, this running of this tipper zone, it costs some money, but it makes from street prostitutes bothering a lot of people around in the cities the most silent and most safe place. But since now, nobody has courage to and also money to open very same safe place also in the Czech Republic.
Hanna Malinova there talking to Dominic Yoon. Now, more than three decades after the first plans were drawn up, the D8 motorway connecting Prague and Dresden has finally been completed. A ceremony marking the official opening of the last stretch of the motorway took place on Saturday. However, one lane of the motorway still remains closed due to continual concern about the geological stability of the land beneath. Ruud Frankova has more.
It was all smiles as President Miloš Zeman, Transport Minister Dan Ťok, Saxony Minister President Stanislav Tillich and other top officials cut the ribbon at the opening of the long-awaited final stretch of the D8 motorway connecting Prague with Saxony in Germany. But the project, launched back in 1984, continues to be dogged by controversy even after being officially completed. The use of the final 16-kilometer link between the towns of Lovosice and Řehlovice is still restricted due to unstable land. Jan Kroupa, the general director of the State Roads and Motorways Authority, told Czech television there was no danger from using the newly opened D8 motorway.
If we had even a shade of doubt, we'd have never opened the highway. This is why only the right lane on the stretch above Pratskovice remains closed. We are, of course, monitoring the situation in the area, but I think no one has to fear using the D8 highway.
Prime Minister Bohuslav Sobotka, who did not attend the opening ceremony on Saturday, has remained more cautious.
If anything happens in the future that would threaten the stability of the highway, then we have to take necessary measures and even close down the highway altogether if it's needed.
Včetně například uzavření dálnice v budoucnosti. Ani to se nedá vyloučit. With 17 bridges and two tunnels, the 16-kilometre stretch of highway is said to be the most complicated traffic construction in the Czech Republic to date. The motorway runs through several nature reserves and there are no petrol stations or rest areas on this part of the road to minimise the impact on nature. The originally estimated cost was some 3 billion crowns. The final price tag increased to nearly 15 billion crowns due to continual technical problems and delays, including a major landslide in 2013, which buried part of the motorway under construction. The project has also been delayed by protests from environmentalists who criticise the chosen route through a protected landscape area and nature reserve. Miroslav Patrik is the head of a non-governmental environmental group called Children of the Earth.
We wanted to protect not only citizens but also nature in the protected area of České Středohoří. This is the only highway running through a nature reserve and as such required an exception from the Ministry of the Environment. In our opinion, this was a mistake and the ministry should have pushed for a tunnel.
For the people living in the nearby towns and villages who had to deal with heavy traffic for years, the completion of the D8 motorway is definitely good news. An estimated 70,000 cars passed under their windows each day and are believed to have claimed 7 lives in traffic accidents each year.
Ruud Frankova reporting there on that rather long and expensive road saga. Now we're joined in the studio by Ian Willoughby for the latest sports news.
We begin with biathlon, and at the weekend, all eyes were on Nové Město na Moravě. It was the venue for the latest round of the Sports World Cup, which reached a climax on Sunday. Over 4 days, more than 123,000 cheering supporters crammed into the resort's Vysočina Arena, where the final event brought the greatest moment, victory for Gabriela Kokalová in the women's mass start race. Kokalová, who's 27, has 2 silver medals from the 2014 Winter Olympics, World Championship gold from the mixed relay, and is the defending World Cup champion. But she says nothing tops her famous victory on Sunday.
It's the most beautiful moment of my career. It's got me wondering if anything could be greater, if I'm at all interested in going to Olympics. I just can't imagine greater emotion than this. I was feeling fantastic today. I don't recall feeling that good since the Olympics. I'm in better shape physically than I was last year. I hope I can make my shooting performances more stable in future so that we can experience such results with our fans more often.
Biathlon has become very popular in this country in the last 5 years, and Czech television reported on Saturday that the women's pursuit final had been viewed by 1 million people. That's a new milestone for the sport. Coach Andrej Rybář is the man credited with making the Czech Republic an international powerhouse in biathlon. He too ranks Kokalová's win in front of home fans in Nové Město na Moravě very highly indeed.
I don't know if Hans Christian Andersen could write a better fairy tale. For us, it was literally a golden finish. It was just the culmination of everything that's happened here in the last 4 days. The emotions here have probably been more intense than we've experienced elsewhere. These are moments that stay with you. Medals can get dusty, but nobody can take those moments away.
Kokalová's first place finish on Sunday was her 14th in the Biathlon World Cup in her career. However, she remains third in the overall rankings this season, 105 points behind Germany's Laura Dahlmeier. Staying with winter sports, and Czech snowboarder and alpine skier Ester Ledecká has just announced a lucrative sponsorship deal with Coca-Cola. In the past, the 21-year-old has used sponsorship money from snowboarding to fund her skiing career. And she's extremely rare in being a top athlete in 2 different disciplines. Moving on briefly to soccer, and 2 Czech players found the net in Italy's Serie A on Sunday. International midfielder Ladislav Krejci converted a penalty in Bologna's 3-0 win over Pescara, and Patrick Schick scored for Sampdoria in their 2-1 defeat to Chievo. That's all the sports news for today.
Ah. And we stay with Ian Willoughby for our regular feature, One on One.
Sunday was the fifth anniversary of the death of Václav Havel, the Czech dissident who led the Velvet Revolution and went on to spend nearly 13 years as president. But before he became a politician, Havel was, of course, a playwright, and it's just his literary work that is the focus of Reading Václav Havel by David S. Danaher, a Slavic studies expert at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. When he visited our studios recently, we discussed, among other things, the author's legacy and relevance today. But I first asked Danaher what had led him to Czech.
Like many Slavists of my generation, I came to Czech through Russian, and I had the opportunity to learn Russian in high school, which was quite unusual in the early 80s in the United States. So I studied Russian as an undergraduate at the university and only started Czech in graduate school. And before Czech, I took Polish, so I kind of migrated west in Slavic cultures and fell in love with Czech and fell in love with Prague in particular and kind of stuck with it.
Typically, who are your students?
It varies considerably. I teach Czech language at the introductory and intermediate levels, and we normally have a number of heritage speakers of Czech who have varying degrees of fluency, usually at the lower levels. But then we have students who simply want to take a more exotic language. The typical language is Spanish or French or German, and they see Czech in the timetable and are excited about doing something different.
Obviously, the internet has transformed life for those who are studying the languages and cultures of faraway countries. But typically, what Czech sources do you find you use the most?
I do try to use the internet a great deal. YouTube videos, we listen to a number of songs. But the thing I think that helps most of all, because Czech is, as you know, a complicated language for English speakers, and one of the difficulties is this kind of distinction between literary Czech and spoken Czech. So we use a lot of films in my sequence at the University of Wisconsin, because that's really the way you get to see spoken Czech or hear spoken Czech in action. You can't really discuss it theoretically, you can a little bit, but students, you know, really need to see it and hear it in action in order to understand what, how those differences work.
Just as a matter of interest, what particular films are popular with your students?
Well, we do older films because I've had to develop materials for them, so that takes a long time and I don't have the time to do newer films. But we do Dark Blue World, we do Loves of a Blonde by Miloš Forman, which is a wonderful, delightful film as well. And then for more advanced students, we do the film that's translated as Divided We Fall, Musíme si pomáhat in Czech. We do that because it's more hypothetical, the language is a little more difficult.
Last year you brought out the book Reading Václav Havel. What was your main aim with that book?
Well, I've been teaching a monograph course on Havel since 2002, and I teach to what I would call naive readers of Havel, that is, students who aren't specialists in literature, who don't necessarily, and usually don't, in fact, know much at all about Havel before the semester begins. These days, they don't even know what the Cold War is, really, and I have to explain that to them. And what I noticed in teaching this course was that Havel manages to resonate with students who don't know anything about his particular context. And I wanted to explore that in book form, and it took me a very long time, about 10 years of teaching this course before I started writing the book, to come to that topic. Because traditionally, Havel is viewed through a historical lens or a biographical lens. And that's fantastic scholarship and necessary scholarship, but it kind of leaves us on the side, this question of Havel's resonance to naive readers. So that's primarily my motivation for writing the book.
Do you find there's any typical misconception about Havel as a writer?
I think one of the things that I would emphasize is that he's associated often with a critique of socialist Czechoslovakia or of totalitarian Central Eastern Europe. And certainly that is true, that critique is there. But we also have to realize that there are two levels of analysis in a lot of what Havel wrote. And in the book, I talk about the domestic level of analysis, that is this critique of the socialist countries. But there's also what I call the existential level of analysis. Havel was quite aware of the crisis of modern democracy, coined the term post-democracy, which didn't stick. And so we also have this critique of modern society in general in a lot of Havel's work, certainly in the plays, but also in some of the more famous essays. And that level, that higher level, that broader level of critique tends to be missed by many readers.
And does Havel's reputation as a dissident, politician, human rights campaigner, does that in any way impact, for better or for worse, appreciation of him as an actual writer?
Well, that's also a good question. And I focus in the book on Havel as a writer primarily because I think that we tend to focus on Havel as a political activist in one way or another, dissident or president, and of course his major contributions to human rights worldwide. But Havel, for me, is primarily a writerly thinker. And one of the things I emphasize in the book is that, you know, what we associate with Havel's plays is this notion of the appeal, the provocation. And in the book, I argue that this is true really of all of Havel's genres, and I include political activism as one of the genres. And so when we view Havel through that lens of an appeal-oriented writer and thinker, I think we tend to read his various genres a little bit differently.
Havel's plays were largely in the tradition of theatre of the absurd, which I guess is regarded now as a genre of the past. Are his plays still relevant today?
I think his plays are still relevant, although I would agree that the theatre of the absurd is tends not to be the kind of theatre that we see on stages these days. I've seen productions of Havel's plays in the modern American context that are adapted to a modern American reality, and they still have considerable effect on the audience. But of course, that largely depends upon directors' decisions.
Is there a sense that the philosophical writings, such as The Power of the Powerless, which has been translated into so many languages and I believe is still read by dissidents around the world, is there a sense that that kind of writing overshadows his plays?
So this is a question that I deal with in the book, because Havel wrote in many genres, and the primary genres would be plays and essays and then presidential speeches after 1989. And for me, those are all literary works. I read the political essays primarily as literature. And I think that when we read Havel, we need to read across those genres. We need to have a holistic or integrative reading of Havel, because Havel was very sensitive to how form affects meaning. And so the plays represent, say, the idea of dissent in a performative way on the stage, whereas the essays treat it more theoretically or abstractly. And so we can't just look to the essays and say this is Havel's definitive word on dissent. We also have to read them simultaneously, side by side with the plays, and understand that Havel was exploring this topic from various angles or through various experimental forms.
Is there any single work by Havel that for you will be or could be his legacy long into the future?
Oh, I think we'd have to say it's going to be Power of the Powerless. With the current results of the American election, I've noticed a lot of people suggesting that we all read Power of the Powerless again. And as you said, it's been read throughout the world and translated into many languages.
I was reading that in reading Václav Havel, you set English translations alongside Czech originals to explore what's lost in translation. Does that mean that you think Havel hasn't been translated as well as he ought to have been?
Absolutely not. Havel's main English translator, Paul Wilson, is absolutely fantastic. I've had many arguments in my head with Paul Wilson over certain translation, and he always wins those arguments. And I've talked to other Bohemists who have had the same kind of arguments, and Paul Wilson is always right. I think it's a question of cultural translation, and that's really what I explore in the last chapter of my book, that this idea that words that seemingly translate easily or have only one possible translation, an example would be Czech svědomí translates as conscience, nonetheless, against the background of each language, Czech and English, they have startlingly different meanings. And we can investigate those meanings. We have tools to do that now. We have Czech National Corpus and English language corpora that help us do that. And so I explore those sometimes very subtle differences in meaning as a way of entering into Havel's thought, because these are really key words in Havel's thinking.
From your perspective, what was Havel's best period as a writer?
I think Havel was a brilliant playwright prior to 1989. He was certainly a brilliant essayist prior to 1989. I think the works, for me, that are undervalued are the presidential texts and really the speeches. He did do other things as president, but the speeches are just wonderful gems, and they are all available online, most of them in English translation, not all of them. And I would really urge people to take a look at those speeches on a wide variety of topics. And they address modern problems, globalization, climate change, and the responsibility that we have as human beings to confront those problems.
When you introduce your students to Havel, what is it that typically grabs them?
I think they enjoy the playfulness of Havel. We start by reading some of Havel's visual poetry, which he called the Anticodes. And it's very, very playful poetry. It can be interpreted in a lot of different ways. So the students enjoy coming up with various readings of each of these antichodes that we read, and then we discuss why Havel called them. He coined this term antichode. So I think what students enjoy is that Havel appeals to them to co-create the meaning of each text. That's less prominent in the essays than it is in the antichodes in the plays and also in the speeches. But I think once that's pointed out to the students, they really get into the idea of figuring out what it all means for themselves.
Maybe I'm kind of going back over ground that we've covered a bit, but now, 5 years after his death, what shape is Havel's reputation as a writer in today?
Well, I do think that we're in danger, especially with celebrating what would have been his 80th birthday, of kind of relegating Havel to, say, the museum context and no longer reading him. And I think that would be a terrible shame, because I do think a lot of his works are still very relevant to the present, maybe even more so than they were a few years ago with the kind of political trends that are happening in both Europe and America.
David S. Danaher there speaking to Ian Willoughby. And if you've any comments about that feature or anything else in our programme today, then please feel free to write to us at email at english.radio.cz or on Facebook and Twitter. We'll be extremely happy to hear from you. But from me, Chris Johnston, thanks very much for today and goodbye.